Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Samer Madanat, director of the UC Berkeley Institute of Transportation Studies, and I'm your moderator for this evening. What we'll be talking about tonight are the prospects for the California high-speed rail. In the recent past, the High-Speed Rail Authority has issued a new business plan and new budget estimates that are significantly lower than the initial ones, about $30 billion. And with this, there has been an increased hope that the California high-speed rail system will actually see the light of day. What we're going to try to talk about today are the details of this, but also talking more broadly about some of the policy and economic issues and social issues associated with high-speed rail. With us, we have Ian Mitroff, the founder of the Mitroff Crisis Management and also a professor at UC Berkeley in the College of Environmental Design, immediately to my left. Paul Safo is the managing director of Foresight at Discern Analytics. He's a forecaster with over two decades of experience exploring the dynamics of large-scale, long-term change. And last but not least, Will Kempton, who is currently the chairman of the peer review group for the high-speed rail system. He's been the CEO of the Orange County Transportation Authority since 2009, OCTA. And OCTA is responsible for planning, financing, and coordinating Orange County's various transportation systems. Prior to that, Will Kempton was the director of the California Department of Transportation, better known as Caltrans, where he served and was appointed by ex-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. So please welcome me in welcoming our panelists. So the prospects are clearly more positive for high-speed rail than they were, say, a few months ago or a year ago. Accordingly, quite a few people are feeling quite optimistic that high-speed rail will see the light of day in California. I'd like to start the Q&A by asking our panelists two questions. The first one is, can it be built? And the second one, kind of which should be the first one in a logical order, is should it be built? But we'll start with the can question, I think, because this is where issues of risk and finance and political climate come into play. So, Ian, do you want to start?
Well, I have to pass on the first one, can it be built? You know, I have a background in engineering. I'm more of a general social scientist. And we had a very interesting discussion in the room before we came on the stage here, talking about the broader social political issues. And they revolved around a number of issues. One, can a state of this size, this important, this magnitude, this economy, afford not to build something like this, not to do something bold and daring? I happen to be a member of the Paul Krugman School of Economics that when your house is on fire, it's not the time to conserve water. I understand we run deficits, but what will get this economy, make sure the recovery is going? So we talked a lot about the cultural factors. The last thing I think we ended up with is something that in my career that I've worked on, I call the type 3 error. It's not commonly known in statistic, but it's the probability of solving the wrong problem precisely. And what good does it do to solve the wrong problem precisely? That's idiocy. But in order to know whether you're working on the right or the wrong problem, whether this is the thing we ought to be working on, you really have to take a very, very broad view of problems. You have to look at something that one of my former mentors called a mess, which is a whole dynamic systems of problems that are so interrelated that you can't take any problem out of the mess without either destroying the problem and or the entire mess. So you have to say, if it's, or let me back off and say it this way. Many years ago, I was a consultant at General Motors, and they were in the process of turning down building an electric car. And I asked the fellow who brought me in, are you turning it down for the right reasons? And the right reason is that you have a project that's even better, and they lost considerable time, as we all know, in building small, affordable cars and electric cars. So even if one turns down this project, are we turning it down for the right reason? And the right reason is partly because there's something bold that will not only get the state moving again, but a lot of things we're talking about, a new spirit of cooperation, where we stop fighting one another, with the vitriol that characterizes so much of public discourse these days, you know, whether you agree or disagree, what side of the political spectrum, and say, what is it that brings us together as Californians and gives us the energy and the will to move forward?
Sure. Ian's absolutely right. Let's think about some numbers here. California is the world's ninth largest economy. Our gross state product last year was $1.9 trillion, which makes our economy larger than Russia or Canada. The Bay Area alone, if California won't fund it, well, the Bay Area is the world's 19th largest economy. Our economy is larger than that of Switzerland, and last time I checked, the Swiss were pretty good at building trains. So the money is there. We have the resource base if we want to do it. The real issue is something, you know, thinking about the 75th anniversary of the Golden Gate Bridge. You know, here it is. It was built during the Depression. You know, the final bond approval was by the Bay Area counties affected by the bridge. We managed to do that in the middle of a depression. And there's something that's gone screwy with our state. It's not a question of engineering. It's not a question of governance. It's a question of us as citizens. You know, the 1960s, under Pat Brown, this state was capable of doing bold things like the California Aqueduct, the Blueprint for Higher Education. And I'll bet you there are many people in this room who got free education at University of California because of what was done. And those very bold moves set us up for all the competitive advantage we enjoyed. Silicon Valley wouldn't be there but for the Blueprint for Higher Education. But we took those things for granted. And over time, we've forgotten the benefits of, you know, doing things that have payoffs into the future. And so now we're in this very tight political situation where high-speed rail is eminently doable. The problem is that politically, it is so hard to get anything through that people are tempted to make shortcuts which tick off interest groups and cause problems in neighborhoods. There isn't a single issue I've heard about high-speed rail that isn't solvable as long as we learn to cooperate.
Well, Samer, before I answer your two questions, I want to let the audience know about the peer review group in brief. We're a statutorily appointed group that is our client is the state legislature, and we're delegated the responsibility of commenting on the planning, engineering, and financing of the system. There are seven members of our group, and we've been working hard over the past couple of years to provide input to the legislature, some of which hasn't been very complimentary to the high-speed rail authority or the plans. In fact, our comments on the funding plan, which we delivered to the legislature back in early January, were quite harsh. We were accused of being naysayers, of not having a vision, and generally a lot of negative things from a lot of folks that are looking at this project as something that's necessary for California. Fact of the matter is all members of the peer review group support high-speed rail. We think it's a good thing. So the question is, can it be built? I'm not sure. And I'm not sure from a standpoint that doesn't relate to the engineering or the capacity of our state to construct big infrastructure projects. I was director of Caltrans when the Bay Bridge was being finalized in terms of its plans, and I drove by that structure today, and yeah, we can build it. It's there, and it's going to be open to traffic literally on time, as the time has been delayed. Nonetheless, I think there are some socio-political barriers and gates that make the prospect of high-speed rail in terms of can it be built questionable. And I think that's really the issue. We certainly can build it. We have the technological capability. We have the skills necessary to get this project done. And I think, given some of the issues that my my partners on the panel have raised, it can be built. But there's some serious barriers to accomplishing that. Should it be built? I'm a transportation guy. That's not a good question to ask me if you want an unbiased answer. And my answer is yes, it should be built. So should about $250 billion of additional roads and freeways and transit systems and other transportation needs that we have in this state that we must build in order to successfully accommodate the population growth that we're anticipating in the future. High-speed rail, I think, is a significant part of that. I think it can provide some very, very positive transportation benefits. And so should it be built? I say yes.
All right. So I see here that there's way too much agreement on this panel, so I'm going to stir the pot a little bit. Everybody is for high-speed rail, and as a moderator, which means I should be a moderate, I will play the role of the devil's advocate for a minute and ask my fellow panelists two questions regarding should it be built. One is intercity travel our most important transportation problem in the state of California, that it deserves to have to take priority over what I and quite a few people think, quite a few experts in transportation think, is the major problem, which is urban congestion? And that's the first question. And two, and that question maybe is directed primarily at Will Kempton as somebody who directed Caltrans, if indeed it should take priority, does it in any way assist us in solving some of our urban congestion problems in California?
Well, Samer, I think it does. To answer the last part of your question, I think that the service will provide some opportunities for the movement of people on a fairly fast track, excuse the pun, in some of the urbanized areas. The blended approach, which some of you may be familiar with, which is something that the High Speed Rail Authority has now embraced, at least as they move to complete this program, taking advantage of existing conventional rail services on the bookends, the northern end and the southern end of the rail line where it goes to the heavily urbanized areas of California, Bay Area and Southern California. And so I think that there is a very significant opportunity to be able to help alleviate some of the congestion that we experience by providing higher speed train service in those corridors. Now, is it the panacea to congestion in California? No. Is congestion still going to be a problem that we need to address? Yes. But I believe there are definitely some benefits to be derived, even in the urbanized areas, from high-speed rail. It's awfully tough to make a value judgment in terms of saying, do you want to it's like saying, do you want to build the best university system in the world in California? But do you also want to have a very good California State University system to go along with that? You don't. Anybody that's interested in education or has children in college doesn't want to have to make the choice to say we're going to go with the UC system or we're going to go with the California State University system. You want to see if you can improve both. And so from a transportation perspective, as I said at the outset, I am very biased when it comes to transportation. I think it's vital to our economy and our quality of life. I think we need to figure out how we balance this out. It's not a matter of spending $68 to $98 billion all at once. It's a long haul to get a system like this built and in place, and I think we need to be looking to invest in transportation infrastructure that will help us with our congestion in the urbanized areas, as well as those are transit facilities or whatever, as well as a high-speed intercity passenger rail system.
I would just say I think it's a false question, honestly, saying whether it's the most important transportation priority or the most important spending priority, because when you ask a question like that, you can never answer it. I mean, we should not be in a situation where we're performing economic triage. by saying, well, if we have to build high-speed rail, then we're not going to do something else, because that's, last time I checked, not the way state funding works. But as an idea that makes sense, anybody who's been stuck in fog at SFO or Burbank or Los Angeles knows that there is value to having multimodal transport between our major urban areas. Doesn't solve our local problems, but, you know, interestingly enough, with the latest version of high-speed rail, it does help some of our urban problems by doing the hybrid system. So I just think it's the wrong question.
Let me add on. You know, I would I'd really reorient the question to, beside all the technical economic details, I'd ask the question that maybe seems completely out of left field. Is this the kind of project that will help heal this state in terms of the social distress that we have? And I don't mean urban crime and all the rest of that, but something that will help us cooperate with one another and revisit. One of the discussions we were having in the back room before we came up here is about the need to redo some of our basic myths that come from the very founding of this republic. One of Robert Reich's best books, I think, that has not received the play that it really deserves is Tales of New America. And in that book, Reich outlined four myths that have governed us right from the very founding of the republic. One is the rot at the top, all the despots from whom we fled Europe, and they're now your CEOs or whatever you want to call them, government bureaucrats. He talked about the mob at the gates, and the mob can be whatever illegal immigrants, whatever the victim is of the day. He talked about the benevolent society, American can never do any wrong, not that it's bad. But the last one he talked about was the triumphant individual. And we live in a world that is so interactive that it's really time to talk about the triumphant social group, the socially responsible group, not just the mob. And so the point is that projects of this kind, really big projects, don't just speak to technical transportation needs, but they speak to underlying social needs. And those social needs are not always obvious or evident. And I think that's one of the discussions we have. I'm not an expert on the economics of it. You know, I have a master's in structural engineering from Berkeley. I was one of the beneficiaries of the California education system when it was cheap, virtually free, to get a UC education all the way from freshman to PhD. If I told you what I paid, the young people in this audience would literally have a heart attack. And we need to revitalize this the system of education. Now the question is, does this kind of project contribute to that? So how do we view this project, not narrowly, but expansively, not so expansively that it just, you know, floats into the clouds, but allows us to link up with some of our other vital, pressing social problems? That's the kind of question that I would ask.
Thank you, Ryan. Well, we've received quite a few questions from the audience, and I think it's a good time to start looking at these. The first one, I think, is very much directed to you, Will. What were the changes in the HSR plan that resulted in a lower cost estimate? And are these cost changes realistic? Could we get a fixed price contract from a construction consortium?
Well, the major changes in the revised business plan that resulted in the reduction in cost of about $30 billion are the fact that they have adopted the blended approach, which means that they're going to be using or taking advantage of existing conventional rail with upgrades to accommodate the train operations between San Jose and San Francisco and between basically Palmdale and Anaheim. By doing that, they're avoiding or putting off a very significant amount of the costs associated with the project. The other thing is that they're planning to do it faster, which from an inflationary perspective substantially reduces the costs as well. So that's achieved by their calculations at about a $30 billion savings over the high number. It's actually not the high number, but the range that they came in with earlier or late last year, which was $98 billion. So that's the prime reason for the reduction.
Okay. A A broader question here. In the initial plan, I'm paraphrasing here, but in the initial plan that was voted on by California voters and which gave the okay to move ahead with bonds for high-speed rail, the ridership estimates were very high and the cost estimates were quite low. Since then, the costs estimate have increased about 50% and the ridership forecast have declined. Given that that is not exactly what we voted, what we paid for, or what we agreed to, should the California public have another vote?
Well, two thoughts. One, forecasts like this, every infrastructure project, you know, you look back over the last 100 years, and every infrastructure project has always been a short-term economic loss and a long-term economic benefit. You can go all the way back to the railroad bubble in the 1860s in England, where it was the high, it was the internet bubble of its age, took off like a rocket. Everybody was invested. The market crashed. People fled the country. There was a call to arrest the guilty and the like, and everybody said, "Well, that was stupid." And then you came back by 1900, and there was 10 times as much track in England as there was when the bubble burst. So you always see with infrastructure projects, you know, the first thing loses money, and then the next phase enjoys benefits. And as a forecaster, I am pretty sure that's what will happen with California's high-speed rail, no matter what the numbers are. And in terms of ridership, nobody knows. But if you look at elsewhere around the world with high-speed rail systems, the systems are used. And more generally, let us not forget, there are all sorts of things that everybody called a folly when they were built and things that people hated, you know, like the Transamerica Pyramid. Now it's part of our skyline and much loved. The Bay Bridge or the Golden Gate Bridge, it couldn't be built, and so on. So you always have this tension between the prediction and what actually happens. But in the long run, the projects like this always end up having a very strong benefit. So the right perspective on this project is to put yourself in the shoes of someone 20 years from now looking back and saying, was this the right move or not?
Do you have anything to add to this?
Well, I mean, what Paul says, I mean, one of the we talk a game, but we really don't play the game. If we were in the shoes of future generations looking back, what would they have desired and asked about this project? I hope it would not be the case that you should have built it sooner. You should have had a different kind of economic analysis, and I think that's what Paul raises, to really take it seriously, plus all the other stakeholders that we don't hear because we don't do a good job of asking them and monitoring them in projects like this.
I have two questions here.
Can I just one other thing about this? Should the Californians vote again? So show of hands, how many people think we should have another vote on this? Good for you. Here's my take. I think actually California is suffering from a problem, and it's being exploited by the political class. Our problem is we have too many feedback loops between our leadership and the public. You know, we complain about too few. The fact is we have too many. This state is being legislated by citizens. We've created these barbed wire fences with propositions that were financed by special interests, sold to gullible publics. You know, and we all know the examples of what those are. Term limits was put in specifically so to get rid of Willie Brown out of Sacramento. And the public gullibly went along. Now, that may not be a bad thing. I don't know. He's a heck of a good columnist. And now we see this new twist on propositions. So we had a redistricting vote. And the people who funded redistricting, guess what? The redistricting didn't go the way they wanted it to politically go. So what did they do? They sued. And then they lost their suit. And then they also said, well, we need another vote again. You know, so this is like special interests in California, you know, because ordinary citizens can't get propositions in anymore. It is impossible for a citizens group without funding in this state to get a proposition approved. Look at Schwarzenegger. Look at what people, you know, try to do. So it's all special interest, and if they don't get it the first time, they're going to come back a second time. And let's face it, that's what's happening with this call for a second vote on high-speed rail. They didn't like the result the first time, so they're going to try again. As citizens, we shouldn't stand for this.
Let me take two questions that are very related. I'll quote from one of them and hope that I'm addressing both here. Isn't an incremental approach better or more doable? And specifically, the better idea is incremental upgrades to current marginal regional rail services, such as Bay Area to Sacramento, Bay Area Stockton, Modesto, Central Valley, etc., LA Palm Springs. Upgrade to 110, 125 miles per hour, electricity, service every 30 minutes, and later on you do the SoCal, this Southern California part of that. Isn't that a better approach? Well, I think you're well positioned to answer.
Sammer, generally I agree with that. Obviously, somebody's from Northern California. I live in Southern California now, so I might have a different view on which increment went first. But I would tell you that this project is not going to be built in any other way, in my judgment. It's not like you're going to see a $98 billion expenditure of funds over 7, 10, 15 years, whatever it is, and there you have your complete high-speed rail system in place. It's going to have to be done incrementally, and that's what the High-Speed Rail Authority has now proposed, which I think is a substantial improvement over what they originally offered. The thing that concerned my group was the fact that we didn't want to see a stranded investment. We didn't want to see a $6 billion investment in the Central Valley that didn't hook up to anything. Now, they were planning to use it for the San Joaquin service in the Central Valley, and it would hook up at Merced and go as far down towards Bakersfield as they could get it. But we didn't think that was a particularly good idea. Now, they're talking about let's do that investment, then let's focus on the connection between Bakersfield and Palmdale, which, by the way, for those of you that may not be familiar with the state's intercity passenger rail system, is a gap. We have no rail connection in that particular corridor, and by building that, that's not a lost investment. Whether or not high-speed rail ever comes to California, we will be able to take advantage of that piece of the investment. Same is true of the investments in the urbanized areas, the blended approach. Those improvements to the rail systems will benefit Caltrain, they'll benefit the Metrolink service down in Southern California with or without high-speed rail, but they can lend themselves to that incremental approach. That's how you build these big projects. The interstate system wasn't built in a day. It wasn't built in a matter of 10 years. It took several decades to get the system finally completed. And that's sort of the approach that we're going to have to take with high-speed rail. $9 billion has been approved by the voters. That's obviously not going to be enough. We need to get to a point where there are some operating segments in place that can attract some private investment. That's not the end-all of the situation, but piece by piece, we can get this system in place.
Let me pose it a different way. It goes back to something Paul said earlier, that are we raising the issue in the right way? Of course, incrementally, it makes sense from an economic, technical standpoint. It's hard to argue against that. But if you think about it, my big part of my background, the major part is in philosophy and psychoanalysis, that if you raise it as a moral, ethical question, would we say to take an incremental approach to human rights? That's almost absurd. You wouldn't say that. No, you want to. You don't want to do that. You don't want to take an incremental approach. So the question is, yes, of course, it's an economic, it's a technical problem. You'd have to be out to lunch not to recognize that. But what other kinds of problems is it at the same time that doesn't fall under that rubric? Is it not in addition to be technical, social, political, an ethical, moral question? And if it is, if you phrase it that way, then what kinds of questions are you led to ask and what kinds of responses do you get? So whenever you just say incremental, I have to think of areas of human life where we don't want to take an incremental approach. Of course, we'll take it here, but that only begs the question.
Well, incrementalism, I think you're both right. Politically, incremental is going to be the best we can hope for, but as citizens, what we have to cross our fingers and hope that it's incrementalism with a consistent long-term vision. I mean, Will, when you were running Caltrans, you did a great job of keeping the focus on the long-term. The way you make it cost-effective is you do it incrementally and you deal with what is possible, but behind that is a consistent long-term vision so you're not veering and changing directions and losing money. And it's an idea with a long tradition. That's how they used to build cathedrals in Europe is, little by little as they could, but they had a consistent long-term vision. And that's really what we're talking about here, not just high-speed rail. I'm not so sure high-speed rail is going to inspire future generations, but I think they'll be grateful for the traffic, the ability to travel. But if we think about California in general, we need to think about what are the things we can do today that are the social equivalent of the cathedrals, the things that people 20, 30, 40 years from now will look back and say, those folks right around turn of the century were pretty wise in terms of the things they decided to focus our efforts on.
Paul, I would agree with what you said. I want to challenge Ion a bit on the incremental approach to certain socio-political kinds of things, and you used human rights as an example. Of course, nobody wants to take an incremental approach to that, but I would submit to you that the civil rights movement was done incrementally. We may not have liked it. It may have been the right thing to do to make it happen right now, but it happened over a long period of time, and even to this day, we're still making incremental progress on civil rights. And so it happens on the socio-political front as well as on projects of this nature. If you could build everything right now, you'd love to do it. That'd be great. If we could just write the check and have this facility up and running in 3 years, that would be a wonderful thing, assuming you're a supporter. But that is not in the cards. A project of this magnitude, just like the cathedrals in early Europe, are going to take time to build, and it is
I don't disagree with that. I was raising in the sense of Paul. It was an incremental in the sense of having a consistent, bold vision. Mm-hmm. That was an incremental. Obviously, the building, the implementation of it is, but keeping the eyes on the prize was not incremental, and people didn't vary and lose sight of that, and that's what I'm talking about.
Very true.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's bring us back to high-speed rail from this broad discussion about human rights. And this one is for you, Will. As an official of the Transportation Authority, can you comment on the significance of the authority, I believe they mean the High-Speed Rail Authority, as an institutional form for financing and administering infrastructure? What are the long-term implications of this form?
Well, we are not a part of the High-Speed Rail Authority. We actually are an adjunct of the legislature, and the legislature is our client. We were certainly created as part of the program and to provide some degree of oversight and input to the legislature on key decisions. I think the creation of a separate authority for the development of high-speed rail makes some sense. It's not to say it's the only organizational structure that might work. I firmly believe, and this is one of the problems that we're going to continue to cite about the current revised business plan, is that the High-Speed Rail Authority does not yet have in place a significant enough management structure to be able to oversee this project. And so we made the very strong recommendation to the legislature that needs to be taken care of as they consider funding for the project. But as a way to do business organizationally in state government, I think it makes sense. The California Transportation Commission has overseen other modes of transportation in California to great effect and great success. So if the High-Speed Rail Authority can serve that function, similar to what the California Transportation Commission has been able to do for other modes of transportation, I think it can work well.
Mm. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guests are Ian Mitroff, founder of Mitroff Crisis Management and a professor at UC Berkeley's College of Environmental Design, Paul Saffo, managing director of Foresight and Discern Analytics, and Will Kempton, chair of the High Speed Rail Peer Review Group and CEO of the Orange County Transportation Authority. Here's a question from the audience that is a little more pointed. Your panel says is talking about high-speed rail in conceptual terms, not the specific proposal before the legislature. Has this proposal been designed cost-effectively to optimize public benefit? Many of the most informed think not. Now, Will, your panel, of course, looked at that question effectively. You are a supporter of high-speed rail, but your panel was quite critical, at least of the original business plan and to some extent of the latest version of it. What can you say about that?
Well, when I said that should high-speed rail be built, I should coin a phrase that has been used by Senator Simidian, who represents the South Peninsula area here in the Bay Area, and that is that he favors high-speed rail, but he favors it done right. I have the same idea, and I think that that's what prompted the peer review group to object to the proposal or the proposed strategy when the funding plan was presented in early January. I think the High-Speed Rail Authority, the current members of the authority, have listened. They've taken a lot of community input, and I think that they've made adjustments accordingly. And so I believe that with the connected system that they're proposing, the fact that we won't be left with stranded investments, that there is independent utility in terms of what they're proposing to be built, that those are all very positive things. And again, I view this from an incremental perspective. I'm not a lawyer. We don't have any lawyers up here today, which is, I think, a good thing. Nonetheless, there are those that would say you're violating Proposition 1A, you're not following the tenets of the measure. But again, I come back to this. Look, as long as our other panelists said, as long as you don't lose that vision, as long as your eye is on the prize and that you're moving towards that ultimate project, an incremental approach is what it is going to take to achieve success.
Very good. Going back to a broader level, here we have two questions that are asking essentially the same thing. What is the cost of not doing high-speed rail? You know, if given growing population, gas prices, limits to airport expansion, etc. So what are the costs of not doing it economically, socially, and from an environmental point of view? Thoughts on this?
I think we have no idea what the costs are of not doing it, because infrastructure projects always pay off in unanticipated ways. They're usually created for one purpose and put to an entirely different purpose. You know, we're here on the edge of Silicon Valley. Think about packet switching. And part of the origins of packet switching indirectly tie to the Defense Department's desire to have a communication system that would survive nuclear attack. And it was funded in the depths of the Cold War as part of our national security strategy. Now, luckily for us, they were funding hippies here in Silicon Valley who had rather different ideas. And the completely unintended consequence was the Internet. Who would have guessed in 1967 that Defense Department dollars spent on a small project would lead to an explosion in electronic commerce and all the wealth in the Bay Area? The same thing with the Interstate Highway Act. You know, the origins of that also indirectly go back to the Pentagon's desire to move tanks around the country. Nobody guessed that it would be valuable moving 18-wheelers and goods around the country. So if we don't build it, we'll always wonder, because I can guarantee you the biggest benefit that will come from high-speed rail is going to be something vastly bigger than we can possibly imagine, and most certainly something we couldn't guess at today.
Let me take another response. I mean, as somebody who spent his entire career in a business school and was taught cost-benefit analysis, it's almost virtually useless, not because it shouldn't be used, but because the ways that it's used are so highly flawed. People usually do it as though there's a single point estimate, like a single answer, the way we're schooled, improperly schooled, because it's all so critically dependent on the assumptions that one makes. And were we to really have the discussion, we were having some of this backstage, and say, what are some of the major assumptions underlying this project? And if those assumptions are invalidated and revalidated, whatever it is, what different kind of conclusions do you reach? And that really is the heart of the matter. And that's really what we talk about the least in most of these kinds of discussions. What are the critical assumptions? How do we get them out? How do we challenge them? And we were really, really talking about. And obviously some of the prior assumptions were overly optimistic. Okay, once you get by that, then you have to say, well, what are the other assumptions? And that is, you know, what are the other problems that it leads to? You know, what kinds of thinking does it do? Does, you know, other kind of projects that it might lead? And those are what I really wish we would address ourselves to in the time we have remaining.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to make a comment. I wish I was one of those hippies in the Silicon Valley, by the way. I think that would have been
it's not too late.
I think that there, you know, what Ian and Paul have said, it makes a lot of sense. But there are some very specific transportation benefits to high-speed rail. I hear the argument made that the airlines will simply lower fares and the airlines have the capacity to add more service, et cetera. Well, they don't. We have one of the busiest air corridors in the world between Los Angeles and San Francisco. We have extreme limitations at those airport facilities. They're not able to significantly expand, not only in terms of runway capacity, but also in terms of gates. And then think about the ground access to these airports. Think about building new airports in the area. I can tell you in Orange County, when we tried to build a new airport facility at the old El Toro Marine Base, that didn't go anyway. It fell flat. And so there are some very significant restrictions on the ability to expand air capacity in this corridor. Moreover, State Route 99 and Interstate 5 are heavily traveled facilities. They are facilities that serve an economic benefit in terms of the movement of goods, not just people. So to the extent that you can provide an alternative transportation mode to carry people in that north-south corridor, I think that that's a very positive thing. And the cost to upgrade those facilities would also be extremely expensive. So I agree with what Ian and Paul have said, but there's some of my transportation-related perspective.
And let's not forget the climate benefits. You know, rail is a really special kind of transportation category. Even if you know, a less enlightened Caltrans, decades before Will was in charge of it, tried to shove freeways down the throat of San Francisco, and look how long it took us to get rid of the one on the Embarcadero. Even people who are horrified by the thought of more freeways and internal combustion engines like rail. Rail is incredibly efficient in terms of greenhouse. Airlines are not. So even if we could put more airlines into SFO, and we surely will with advances in air traffic control technology, it's still environmentally a much cleaner way to move people around the state. I have one other addition.
Right.
Last time I checked, thank heavens, TSA hasn't invaded rail yet in this country.
So let me interject here some contrarian views on Paul's response and the generally positive view of high-speed rail. On the environmental question, yes, trains run on high-speed rail would run on electricity, but that electricity has to be generated somehow. And it depends what the electricity mix is. So in countries like France, of course, which produces much of its electricity from nuclear power plants, irrespective of the risks of nuclear power, you can certainly say that it is a very low polluting mode. California has a cleaner electricity mix than most of the rest of the country, but it's still to a large degree fossil fuel based. And therefore, you're not seeing the tailpipe emissions, certainly with high-speed rail, but that pollution is happening, and these greenhouse gases are happening. They're happening elsewhere.
Sure. So, yeah, burning Utah coal to run California trains is a really bad idea. It's also a really bad idea for running the air conditioners in the Central Valley, so let's fix that. By the way, France is always pointed to as, you know, a big user of nuclear power. Someone want to shout out who the biggest consumer of nuclear power in the world is? That would be the United States. We generate more electricity with nuclear power than anywhere else in the world. It's just a smaller total percentage because we still have this nasty coal habit. So let's get our trains electric and let's change the power source. We are going to electric aircraft, but I can assure you that large 787-size electric aircraft are way off in our future, perhaps, you know, the second term of the Malia Obama administration.
And on that question, just to close the loop, and two colleagues of mine at UC Berkeley performed a life cycle assessment of high-speed rail and other intercity transportation system, and they found that if high-speed rail trains ran full or at high levels of ridership, high load factors, that is, you certainly would have an environmental benefit here. On the other hand, if you end up with empty rail cars, then that's obviously a very expensive, environmentally speaking, mode of transportation. Let me take the next question, and that's a question which I'll use my privilege as a moderator to answer.
You're outnumbered on this panel.
Well, that's fine. No, I will give you a chance. What lessons can we learn from high-speed rail planning and experience in other countries, France, China, Japan, etc.? Well, let me take the example of France and Japan, because these are probably the two most successful, now joined by Spain, the most successful example of high-speed rail deployment anywhere in the world. And what we find that worked in all these cases, the elements for success were that you had a large number of high population densities with very efficient local, that is regional, public transportation system to take people to and from the rail stations. Now, the reason why this matters is because in the distance of that we're looking at, San Francisco to Los Angeles or Tokyo to Osaka in Japan, rail is competitive with the airlines. And it's competitive even though, of course, aircraft go faster than trains. The reason is because the access and the egress segments of the trip with rail are much shorter than with air. The line haul, that is the distance covered by air or by train, of course, is faster by air. The question is, therefore, do we have these elements?
Actually,
in California,
we tore these elements out. We had these elements. We had the red car system down in, you know, the interurban railway system in Los Angeles County, which in its day was the largest urban rail system in the United States. We had the key system in San Francisco. You know, get a sense of how things have changed here. When you drive home, if you go south on the peninsula through Brisbane, just south of Candlestick, and you see that big open spot that is a recycling area and a sanitary landfill, that used to be the rail yards for San Francisco. So we tore all these things out in our wisdom, or our, you know, folly. And now we're starting to put them back. And high-speed rail could be part of the solution. This is cathedral building. Look at Los Angeles, how they've gone with their underground railway system. It's hilarious. You know, right after 9/11, there was a terrorist threat phoned in for the L.A. subway system, and the police rushed in to Wilshire Boulevard to one of three subway stations at the time, and then they all stopped, and they literally fell on the ground laughing. They said, it is not possible that a terrorist even knows Los Angeles has a subway system. Well, it's gone from that to the latest extension to the West Side is following exactly the right-of-way of the old red cars. So if you lay in high-speed rail, it, you know, chicken and egg, put the high-speed rail in first. It'll help inspire people to put in more interurban and local trackage. And I will also make a forecast here that the real surprise beneficiary of high-speed rail is going to be in the communities in the Central Valley, where initially, Will's absolutely right. That was a rail system to nowhere to connect, what was it, Merced and Fresno? But once the rail system's in, then it's going to encourage growth along the rail corridors, which could help fight sprawl and slow the, you know, building over of agricultural land in the state.
So in a way, Paul, what you're suggesting here is that whereas some people would say first you need to build the regional public transportation systems, you need to strengthen them, and then you will have the ridership needed for high-speed rail, you're suggesting that high-speed rail will have somehow a transformational effect. And I use that word because this is a word that was used by one of my colleagues, a very respected expert in transportation, who feels that putting the cart before the horse, as I call it, is actually useful because the cart will make the horse run faster.
Well, you assume that one has a choice. With our political system in California and the gridlock we have, this is the best shot we have at doing anything. It's not a choice of high-speed rail versus local rail. Those are completely different authorities. Will is busy down in Orange County working on local issues as well as high-speed. So it is a complete canard to say, well, we should focus on local first and then get around to high-speed rail. That's a recipe for nothing.
Let me, again, approach it in a different way. See, the time is approaching. I've been trying to keep track of the stories that we've been telling tonight, because nothing really big or small gets accomplished without a story, and the best politicians know that all too well and are really good storytellers. So look at the stories we've had. We've had the environmental story. We've had the gridlock, future generations, economic efficiency or inefficiency, success, failure, incremental environment, folly, joke. And as this was going on, I was thinking of this kind of opening storyline, and fill in the details, which are not incidental. Once upon a time, the people of California renewed their commitment to a broader vision. And you can take all of these stories, and they all, and the point of story is that they have a moral point, and they summarize and capture all this. So we've been, you know, tonight we've had all these stories flying back and forth, and the question is, which one of the stories will win out? Which one of the stories will inspire us, however this project goes, to something great, renewing the sense of purpose and will of the state, and hopefully getting beyond acrimony? One of my best students wrote a book on rudeness and incivility in the workplace, very good book, and how to bring that to a whole state beyond a single company is really one of the greatest challenges facing us. And whether a project like this or any project can help to heal the acrimony is one of the things I look at. So you want to call that the cart before the horse? Yeah, now what kind of horses are we trying to lead? And that's the question.
We have about 10 more minutes, so I'll...
I can think of no better place to have a nice long conversation about California policy than on a very pleasant train ride through the coastal range, down the Central Valley, over the Tehachapi, and into Los Angeles Grand Central Station.
It's a good story.
I have about 15 questions left, and we obviously are not going to be able to go through all of them. Let me kind of pick a couple that I think are different from what we've talked about. The first one is going back to the economics, and it says that projects of this magnitude are complicated and costly, the mega projects. And how can we avoid the repeat of cost overruns, such as what happened in Boston in the Big Dig project? The experts on mega projects, a group of European professors wrote a very interesting book that showed that with mega projects, the costs are underestimated and the forecasts are always overestimated. And there are political reasons why this is the case. Is there something that can be done here to avoid this situation? I'd like to hear from Will Kempton, somebody who's an expert on dealing with such mega projects such as the Bay Bridge.
Well, I think one of the things that can be done, first of all, is to have a very effective management team in place. That is a question mark on this project and something that the High Speed Rail Authority needs to address post-haste. We've advised the legislature of that They provided the resources and the capacity to bring people on board, but that's something that needs to be accomplished very quickly. The other thing that I notice about mega projects in this country across the board is that we are getting better at managing risks. And that's something that we didn't do very effectively in the recent past, even. When we were constructing the Bay Bridge, one of the very important elements of trying to control the cost for that project was risk management. And Caltrans, as experienced as the department is in terms of construction and construction management, did not have a very significant resume relative to risk management. So we sent people to training. We brought folks in that had some experience in risk management to help us, help the department become a better risk manager and controlling those risks, identifying them, and taking steps to avoid them and control them. That's obviously going to be a key element with the high-speed rail project, and they are focused on risk management. That's not to say that there aren't going to be cost overruns or there aren't going to be problems with this project, because as Sammer said, with respect to mega projects, the trend is for the cost to be higher than anticipated and for the problems to be more severe than anticipated. But that's one of the key elements, risk management, and I think that the focus is improving on that particular element.
We also have another opportunity here. I also, thank heavens, our California politicians, at their very worst, are nowhere close to what Boston politicians are. I won't go any further on that subject, but I just note two things. We have another infrastructure that is comparatively new, and it's been shaking up the political system, and it could be a very potent policy tool, and that is the World Wide Web and social media. Couple that with transparency, and then get a public that is actually seriously interested in the policy, we can do a lot of things to make sure that the process is efficient and transparent. The missing piece is we need a group of people, ordinary citizens, who are actually passionate about policy and treat politics as something other than a spectator sport that is engaged in 6 weeks before and 15 minutes after each of our general elections. So if we could, it's we got to make policy cool and engage lots of citizens in it and then give them the internet tools to keep track of these things.
I really am a believer in risk management. Unfortunately, like cost-benefit analysis, it's almost always done poorly and wrong. I mean, risk management is you take the probability of something and multiply it, of something happening, and multiply it by the consequences, good or bad. The trouble with that, people always grossly get the probabilities and the consequences wrong. The most classic example is 9/11, low probability, high consequence event, which are excluded from risk management. Not that you don't do it, but if you really want to take that technical part on, which I'd be more than happy to do, boy, the assumptions are really so key. I would never trust a single risk management calculation of anything because it's almost always flawed. That doesn't mean you throw out risk management and risk analysis, not at all. But like everything, it has to be done intelligently. Otherwise, you end up you make things worse because you underestimate the risk, and that's not what crisis management is about. That's totally different. Use it, but use it right.
All right. So we have time for one more question, and this is kind of looking into the future. Is it possible to get voters to authorize another $50 billion of funding to build the remainder of the high-speed rail network? Your thoughts on this?
Will, I think
I would think that would be a very difficult task in this political and economic environment. Given the other needs that face the state in terms of education, public safety, in other infrastructure needs, water, et cetera, I think it would be hard to get a $50 billion bond passed. Governor Schwarzenegger did, in fact, get a $43 billion bond initiative for infrastructure through the voters, a series of five separate bonds that dealt with water, education, transportation. That was not an easy task. The governor put his reputation on the line. He was successful in selling the voters on that. I would think that we're going to have to see a substantial improvement in the economy. And just as Paul and Ian have been talking today, a better sense of collaboration among our leadership for that to happen.
I wouldn't even put the question to the public. The public has more important issues to deal with at this moment in time.
Ian?
Well, again, going back to the story, what kind of story or how are you going to frame it? Everything, every central question is all highly dependent on how you frame the issue. And if you frame it one way, of course, the answer is automatic. Of course, the answer is no. Then the question is, which calls for creativity, how would one frame it as an education problem, not just as transportation, where the investment is so clear and so compelling? And I don't think we're anywhere near that. And that's my question. Who does the framing, and how would you frame the story?
Very good. We'll take one more question and I'll ask for very quick answers. If you had a magic wand, what social political obstacle would you remove in order to secure local funding, for example, for high-speed rail? Amending Proposition 218 to make benefit assessment district financing easier, for example?
Set a plan and don't change course. And don't go back and second-guess it.
All right. Well, our thanks then to Ian Mitroff, founder of the Mitroff Crisis Management and also a professor at UC Berkeley's College of Environmental Design, Paul Saffo, Managing Director of Foresight and Discern Analytics, and Will Kempton, Chair of the High Speed Rail Peer Review Group and CEO of Okta. And we also thank our audiences here and on radio, TV, and the Internet. I'm Simon Madanat, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.